Welcome to this podcast of Sunday nights on ABC Local Radio. I hope you enjoy the program. Time now on Sunday night to say hi to a regular guest, Richard Leonard. Richard, who's got a background in both scholarship and film, particularly from the point of view of the church and religion. Richard is a regular guest on the program and also happens to be a member of the Jesuit Order. Richard Leonard, great to have you back with us. Thanks so much for joining
us. Thanks, John. It's always a pleasure to be here.
Now, we ramble around a few things on this program, but I think we can have a ramble tonight about something that will fix everybody's attention, and that is food. And we begin with the 100-foot journey.
It's a beautiful film, and it's one of those rare films that we can recommend to everybody of every age, I think. Firstly, because there's no sex and violence. So there's a little bit of violence, but not much, and certainly no sex to speak of, and it's all about food. Either make sure you have a booking for food after you see it or you've eaten before you go, because this is one of those great films where you are ravenous at the end of it one way or the other. The 100-Foot Journey is a very curious film in the sense that it's an American production set in France, with the heroes of the story are an Indian family who move into regional or provincial France and open an Indian restaurant. It's based on a best-selling novel of the same name, written in 2010 by Richard Moray. And it goes around the Kadam family, and it starts with their story in Mumbai, when quite indirectly they're involved in a political uprising of not of their consequence. They run a restaurant, and the winner of the election comes to their restaurant, and the crowd who are against him come and basically trash the joint, and they're in serious trouble. So they become refugees initially to England, and then they go to France, and they open a restaurant opposite the Michelin-starred Madame Mallory's restaurant, and she's not happy, played wonderfully by Helen Mirren.
Before we get into those bits and pieces, the co-creators of this film, that's a mix, that's a story, it seems to me, a story in itself.
Yes, I'm not sure how Steven Spielberg and Oprah Winfrey came to be the producers and executive producers of this film, but they are. And apparently, even like their financial backing would be very significant, plus their Hollywood clout. And attracted to a beautiful book. It's a wonderful story, but they had to talk Helen Mirren into doing it. I don't think they would have had a long or complex conversation. I think if Mr. Spielberg and Ms. Winfrey ring you up and say, we want you to go to France for a few months to make a film, I'd say if the money was right, and it would have been, you'd be into that. But it is interesting that they got attracted to this story, and I'm fascinated by it because the whole concept of food, of cooking, of dining, of chefs have exploded on film and television in the last 20 years.
Exploded is an interesting word because I immediately think back to that moment when John Cleese put the last chocolate chip on his mouth.
Yes, and just one wafer thin more.
Another wafer.
Maybe that was the beginning of it. The meaning of life and the man in the restaurant who does explode. I always think of that man, by the way, whenever I go near a smorgasbord or a buffet. I officially hate buffets. Firstly, because I think dining is as much about conversation as it is about food, and the up-down sort of cuts across the conversation, I always find. But secondly, I always think I've got to get my money's worth when I go there. And so normally at the end of those meals, I think about that man, just one wafer thin more, I think I'm going to explode. The same's true when I've been a chaplain on a cruise boat. The amount of eating on cruise liners is actually obscene, but we do divert, I think.
Yeah, and I think that is probably worthy of a singularly long stint in a confessional.
Well, we do have one of the seven deadly sins is greed. And I actually think this is related somewhat.
Gluttony, perhaps.
Gluttony and greed. I wonder about, at the moment, this whole obsession with food. Because we know from lots of other surveys that families don't gather around the table in the way they have. We also know that obviously organised religion is nowhere near attended in any way like it has been for previous generations, of which for almost every religion, sacred meals are somewhat at the centre of things. And yet we've got this preoccupation with food. And I wonder, I think it's all about ritualisation. This film is about history, memory, and ritualization. That's how that's the function the food plays in it. You don't walk away knowing any more about French cuisine or Indian cuisine as a result of this extraordinarily beautiful film, beautifully shot, by the way. But you do know an awful lot about these two people who the food is the vehicle through which we start to unpack their backstory. And, of course, that's at the heart of the New Testament.
Not a plot spoiler, but certainly a critique. Helen Mirren and a French accent.
Yes.
Do they go together?
Yeah, she's good. It's annoying. I'm not a French speaker myself, but I understand a bit and I can say I can get my way through Paris, I guess. But I imagine for people who are French speakers, it will be an annoying film because they move from French to English. I wondered whether just go for English and Americans and English people playing Nazis. You either go for the heavy German accent, which feels all a bit forced, or you just go for the English. And yes, we've already suspended belief, so don't worry, we're on the way. And I would have gone for the English accents, I'd have to say. That said, she's perfectly good. The worry was all the conversations they're having in the square. Everyone does seem to be terribly conversant in English, which is not my experience of provincial France, but obviously things have improved since I was in the countryside a few years ago.
But a good, strong film, nevertheless.
Oh, it's a very moving film. It really is a moving film. It's a bit long. It's 122 minutes. And I'm fairly critical of films in this regard. I think they overstay their welcome. The third act comes as a bit of a surprise because Hassan, who is the son of the man who moves they're refugees, so he moves his family to Europe for safety and wants to open this restaurant. He is a brilliant cook, and he introduces Madame Mallory to new tastes and new ideas of influence of spices and other ways of cooking from the Indian tradition into French cuisine. And she then decides that he is such a genius, he's got such gifts, culinary gifts, that she wants to support him. So her single hat Michelin star, I think I just mixed all my culinary metaphors there, but anyway, my Michelin star restaurant owner decides to promote him, and she does so very successfully. And it really is about homecoming in every way. In fact, this is an incredibly nostalgic film. The word nostalgia comes from the Greek word nostalgia, meaning a yearning to be at home. And everything about this film is about home, and it's about food creating home. I think it's wonderful. On the Indian side, you've got all the memories of the mother who was killed in the uprising at their restaurant. So she's significant in the narrative all the way through, both teaching them how to cook and also being the significant homemaker that they carry all around the world. And you've got Helen Mirren, who has lost her husband and although she lives in her restaurant, so it is her home, she also has to find a home.
Let's talk about the way in which food functions in film, certainly in over recent years. You mentioned this, the food isn't so much the device to just, well, you could go back to things like Who's Killing the Great Chefs of Europe, and food there is just another plot device to sort of push the business on. But you're identifying a strand here in which food is a metaphor for something else. And this is a strand that runs through a series of films that have come out over recent years.
We only have to think of films like Chocolat. And curiously, there are lots of a keen observer. We won't go into too much detail now, but a keen observer will see lots of similarities between this film, 100-Foot Journey, and Chocolat. It's both set in rural France. Both the outsider comes in. Both have different ways of doing it. Both upset the local authorities. One in one film, the priest and the mayor, Chocolat. In this film, the local goddess of the culinary cuisine. And then the other one is Babette's Feast, of course, which has been famously read as a film all about the importance of film as transformation. And I think that's where it intersects with religion, I have to say.
Babette's Feast is probably the best example of that, the intersection with religion, because it's set, it's contrived. It's one of those films that works as a film, but if you know anything about religious history, particularly theology, you know actually that this is the outworking of the theological struggle between a Calvinist view of the world and what in Protestant terms would be called an Arminian view or a Catholic view. And it's the tension between free will and determinism. It's the tension between God's goodness or the fallen world. There are a whole lot of theological images which or arguments which actually come down beautifully realised in the sacrificial act of the meal, because the meal becomes a sacrificial act.
Well, she gives everything she has in Babette's Feast. She wins the lottery, and I think we can have spoilers here because it's been around for a very long time, so if you hadn't seen it, that's your fault. And it's hard to have missed it at some stage. SBS runs it every couple of months, and worth doing too, I might add. Having said that, she wins the lottery and she pours herself into this meal. She spends everything, which is an extraordinary amount of money, we're later told, and to create a memorable meal. There's been an awful lot of ink spilt on Babette's Feast as whether Babette is a Christ figure. I actually think she's more a priest figure, because she's the one who prepares the meal and hosts the meal and is in the background. She doesn't serve the meal. It's a little boy who serves the meal, actually, who waits on the table. But she's the one who, in a sense, orchestrates it behind. I guess there are other allusions to God providing the banquet of life and all of those things. But the transformation, reconciliation, which also happens in a 100-foot journey, where they're opposite each other. They're Indian and French restaurants, and they're against each other. And through food, through friendship, through love, they're transformed and they become friends.
And it's the nature of the moral order. At Babette's Feast, you have a tension between the one who wants to have everything correct and precise and done, and that is the way you achieve goodness through sort of a moral structure that's clean. And Babette intrudes in this, and gradually you begin to see that the gift of the moral order comes from the heart.
Yes.
It's a heart thing.
Yes, it's the gift of her very self, which is actually given in and through the meal. I think rather, a bit stereotypically, some people have said, you know, as you were saying about Protestant and Catholic, that the stark Protestantism of that that remote community in Jutland, and then this French Catholic arrives with the full of the largesse. But there is no question that right at the moment, like MasterChef, all of these shows on television, like it is about generosity, you know. Like this year, I think MasterChef has really improved to what it was in previous years, and its ratings have really improved because it was so much more positive and it was more concentrated on the food. And one of the things they kept saying, the three judges who... Like, if they ran around my kitchen telling me you've got 3 seconds and 2 minutes, I'd just punch them. You know, it just drives me nuts, all that looking at the clock. I know it's part of the dynamic of the show. Having said that, they keep saying, tell your story. They don't want them to do food that they can't do or won't do. They want this food to come out of who they are and give us something of who you are on the plate. I love all of that. That's got such strong religious connotations, not just for Christianity and Judaism, but right across the board for Buddhism, Islam, Hinduism, right across the board, the sacredness of meals, of identifying who we are, and that this is a meal of transformation.
And meals take time. That meals is, you have to sit around and face a group of people over a period of time, which means you exchange relationships.
And they're more formal relationships on the whole. Like if you look at all the Jewish meals, if you look at Christian meals, the Islamic meals, which are in the home, you know, they're quite ritualised. There's a formality to them. Now, that doesn't mean there isn't a place, obviously, for the all-in other. But when we come to religious meals, they're more ritualised and formalised so that people can find their place within the community and they have a predictability, which I quite like. And when you look at the way kitchens are run, they're highly stylized places. There's a very strict hierarchy. Like, I will never go to Gordon Ramsay. I couldn't go to a Gordon Ramsay restaurant. I'm sure Mr. Ramsay's a fine person, and I know he has a public persona. But I don't want to go to a restaurant where people are being humiliated and belittled in the kitchen. If I actually knew that of a restaurant I'd going to, I would prefer not to go there. I'm sure we could get a very good outcome with screaming and yelling and belittling at people. And that worries me about Gordon Ramsay. I want to say a thing about television cooking shows, though. We've got a few curious things. These have exploded. Two Fat Ladies, Jamie Oliver, Delia Smith, Floyd Over Everywhere, MasterChef, My Kitchen Rules, just to name a few. They've absolutely exploded. We can now show that when people watched all these cooking shows for the last 10 or 20 years, they didn't lead to people experimenting with very different cuisine. They led to new kitchens. We actually have never had more kitchens being sold. That's the number one selling product in an Australian home. So people, there's a big theory about this in communications literature right now, that why is it that new kitchens took off just at the same time as people watching cooking shows? Well, they looked at what range, what tops and Arga, stainless steel, Miele, Fisher & Paykel. I don't think we're supposed to mention brands on the ABC. Sorry for that. But nonetheless, Harry, we're getting a new kitchen, and they rip out their old kitchen and put in a new kitchen. That's one thing to note. The second is we have never spent as little time in a room on which we've spent as much money. In comparison to our mothers and grandmothers and, please God, also our fathers and grandfathers
who
spent an extraordinary amount of time and spent next to no money on the room. Now, I know also about real sale value for houses, but we spend an extraordinary amount of money on a room in which comparatively we spend a fraction of the time.
Because we're accustomed to think these days in terms of efficiency of time, and we're in a hurry. So, well, yes, we'd like to cook that soup, but we can easily just whip one out of a packet.
I have a friend of mine, Michael McGurr, who's a well-known writer, who talks about these culinary shows as food pornography, in the richest Greek sense of porneo, that people are looking at it, but then they don't do it at home, but they're looking at it, and they take a pleasure, a vicarious pleasure in the looking of it, because they wouldn't attempt it at home. I find that interesting, to look at MasterChef and think it's culinary pornography.
Salivating.
Yes, which I don't think we'll go too far on that one, but I do think that there is, it's creating memories, and all of these food shows are about the memories in the food and then what they create, which is in that wonderful Christian concept of amanesis.
Is it that we're looking for different ways to express those deep symbols, and popular culture keeps churning them up because they're deeply held, and we just need to find new ways to say them because they are constants?
I wonder about that. I think there are two things that are interested in modern media culture at the moment. The first we've talked about here many times before, that when young people aren't coming to organised religion in any of its forms, what's exploded in the last 30 years are science fantasy, which is all about transcendence. It's all about metaphysics, soul, spirits, angels, just exploded in the cinema. So when people say only sex and violence sell to the cinema, they're quite wrong. It does sell for a particular demographic. What a shock. 23 to 25-year-old males will rush off to sex and violence like it's going out of fashion. But what really goes for big people generally are these science fantasy films, even for teenagers. And so I'm interested in that question. And I'm also interested in the fact that cooking and food, when organised religion, which often has sacred meals at its core, they're on the wane. We need ritual in our lives. We need to ritualise. And we know that our food carries identity. We know it carries memory. And we know that it creates history. The people remember meals. They don't have to be grand meals. They
and
can
it
be
creates
beautiful
bonds.
Meals. Bonds between the groups that are there.
You sit at a meal and you give of yourself to someone else and they give back to you. That's a symbol that people intuitively recognise. They don't have to know theology.
And I think also that it's a bit of an archetype too, because for every world religion that I'm aware of, they have some discourse about eternal banquets. And this is an archetype in classic Jungian terms, way apart from organised religion and theology. Jung talked about these banqueting archetypes so that they predestine that there is another at a table at which we will remember each other. We will share in a meal. Wine as an experience of joy. Like, that's what I love about the wedding feast of Cana, for instance. You know, something like 970 bottles of wine. If you're going to take that story literally, well, that means Mary and Jesus loved a party. Like, I'm going to that wedding reception anytime soon, I have to say.
Oh, that's probably, I think that's probably a useful note on which to wind this conversation up. We can go out with, not with just Mary and Jesus and bottles of wine, but those images that are also associated with food and film history, from Chaplin to Ustinov to John Cleese.
We're touching on the divine every time we eat.
Richard Leonard, Director of the Australian Catholic Office for Film and Broadcasting, thanks so much for joining us once again.
Thanks, John.
This has been a podcast of Sunday Nights on ABC Local Radio. Thank you for listening.